Welcome to SAA's Grumpy Strategists, episode 24, a podcast that looks at all things defence and security from an Australian perspective. And I'm joined by Dr. Marcus Hellyer. I'm Michael Shoebridge.
Hello, Michael.
Marcus, today we're going to talk about missiles, insurgents and schedules.
Great. Missiles, very good.
So missiles, there's been some big news out of the Australian Department of Defence with two missile programs, Javelin missiles for the Army and NSMs, Naval Strike Missiles, for the Navy. And one thing's quite different to the other. But first, what about this Javelin buy?
Yes, the Javelin one didn't get a lot of fanfare, I guess because it doesn't quite fit the narrative of the Australian GWEO enterprise, a guided weapons and explosive ordnance enterprise, where we're meant to be learning to do things for ourselves.
That's the GWEO, really, isn't it? Because there's another E on the end, enterprise.
Fine, the GWEO-E. GWEO-E. Yeah. Anyway, so apparently we're going to buy 350 Javelin missiles, so the anti-tank missile that we saw the Ukrainians using to great effect in the early days of the war in Ukraine, until what happened?
Everybody ran out. Yes, because I remember everybody giving the Ukrainians some of their stockpiles.
I believe we gave the Ukrainians some of our relatively small stockpiles.
So 350 for 150 million Australian, how much is that per missile, roughly?
According to my calculator, it's around about $430,000 a pop.
Right, so they're still not really the cheap and the many. They're the reasonably priced. Can't really use these against anything besides armoured vehicles. Can you?
Oh, you could take out a bunker.
Yeah.
I think we took out some Al-Qaeda technicals. They're converted pickup trucks, you know, so we can use them. And compared to an SM-6 missile that we discussed recently, which go for about 10 million Australian, they're a bit of a bargain. The problem is, of course, is that in ground warfare, there's lots of things to shoot. You're going to burn through 350 missiles pretty quickly. And so, as we see the Ukrainians doing, they adapt and essentially they're using commercial drones, rotary wing drones, and strapping rockets onto them, mortar rounds onto them, and delivering a similar effect. So,
Look, this is very good. Ground launched anti-tank weapon. It proved itself in Ukraine. The performance specifications are impressive, but with 350, you're just going to run out if there's an actual war. And we've already seen that US production couldn't keep pace with the demands of Ukraine. So what's the plan for if there's a war?
For day two of the war?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's what the GWEO enterprise is meant to be answering, but we haven't had a lot of big decisions out of the GWEO enterprise.
There was one last week.
Yes. So one of the first big ones, which was very encouraging, was the announcement that Kongsberg is going to Norwegian company, and we'll say up front, they are a sponsor of the Grumpy Strategists and SAA. We will still endeavour to apply our critical faculties to it.
Mm-hmm.
So the government has announced that Kongsberg will establish a factory in the Hunter Valley to build NSM, which is a maritime strike weapon that can be launched from ships.
This is the one that was just fired from our few remaining Anzac ships, isn't it?
Correct. We have test fired one in the RIMPAC exercise off Hawaii. So pretty good missile, good anti-ship missile.
You know
missile.
What I loved about test firing from an Anzac? It just shows you can still do new things in retirement.
And so NSM and JSM. So JSM is kind of the sibling or the cousin of
but
NSM.
There is something good about the JSM, isn't there? So it's a missile, a cruise missile that can be carried in the belly of the F-35. So doesn't reduce the stealth characteristics of the F-35.
Now, somewhat ironically, is ironic the right word? But anyway, we have been saying for many, many years that our highest priority for evolution of the F-35 program is we want a dedicated maritime strike weapon. And we've been waiting years and years and years for this.
Well, that's because I think it wasn't the Americans'
Correct.
High priority. And the cost of integrating a weapon, if the US doesn't help meet those costs, is prohibitive. It's the integration problem again.
Yeah, so being a junior partner with the US may not be all it's cracked up to be, but as we've seen in other programs. But anyway, we're going ahead with domestic production of NSM and JSM. And broadly speaking, I think this is a good thing.
I think it's a very good thing. And yep, Kongsberg are a sponsor of SAA, but As I understand it, Kongsberg was one of two companies, the other one being Rafael, that proposed producing missiles here in Australia years ago to the Defence Department. So it's taken years for the Defence Department to get one of the two companies that made an offer to actually do what they offered.
Well, it seems like Rafael has kind of given up. I mean, the weird thing is, so Rafael offered to build spike missiles here.
The army missiles.
Yes. So back, essentially,
the Israeli javelin.
Analog of the javelin. So back in 2018, the government said, we're going to build the Boxer, a German combat reconnaissance vehicle here, and it was going to be equipped with which missile, Michael?
The Spike.
The Spike. You would have thought, great, let's start building them here. And for whatever reason, that just never got over the line.
And now,
I would have thought it would have been a no-brainer. We picked the vehicle that was going to use it. Why not build the missile?
And now you can... I can't quite imagine the current government announcing an Israeli weapons manufacturer setting up a factory here in Australia, because it would draw all those protesters from various university campuses to wherever the site was.
It's probably not the ideal moment in time.
Yeah. Anyway, 4 years on from companies proposing to actually start manufacturing missiles here, we have the first big example of that starting to happen.
Yes. And I think this is it's good for a number of reasons. So everybody acknowledges we're not going to build every guided weapon the ADF needs here. You know, so you're going to have to make some decisions. So on what basis are you going to make decisions about which missiles to build here? Well, I think the first one is it has to be a key capability. And all of our strategic guidance under, doesn't matter which government, what era we're in, we still need to be able to defend our northern approaches. Mm-hmm. And so sophisticated, capable anti-ship missiles, very high priority for
us. So sinking ships.
In complex archipelagic littoral terrain, high priority, tick. There needs to be economies of scale. So it's not just a missile that will be used on one platform by one service. So the good thing about the NSM/JSM family is it will be air-launched, it can be launched off ships, and theoretically, as we're seeing the US Marine Corps already do, they have put NSM onto ground vehicles, and that's now part of their new amphibious concept.
So the littoral focus of the Australian Army, they could use an NSM that was ground-launched.
Correct. So that's... Yep. A relatively simple thing to do. So I think there are economies of scale here. So it ticks that box as well. The other box is if you can realize export opportunities, then that makes the business case more compelling. And my understanding is this will only be the second facility in the world that can produce that.
Yes, there's the home factory in Norway, and there's rapidly increasing demand for these missiles, whether it's in NATO or in our part of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, so I think this is, it's that unicorn where it's good for the ADF and there's potentially export opportunities.
Well, I would say there's one other thing that has to be thought through, and I really hope it's thought through with this proposal, and that is if you're doing co-production, so this is a missile that's already being manufactured out of the home factory in Norway, like a lot of other missiles are manufactured out of home factories in the US. Is the supply chain for the Newcastle factory going to just be the same as the supply chain for the home factory? Because there's an example with the US missile, the Patriot, anti-missile missile. The Japanese set up a factory to produce Patriots for the Japanese Self-Defense mm-hmm. Force. 30 a year was what they scaled to produce.
And what happened?
Well, when the Ukraine war came along, everybody put orders in, and the Ukrainians have them. The US and others want to give the Ukrainians more Patriot missiles. The Japanese said, we could scale this production up here in our Japanese factory from 30 to 60. And then they had to say, oops, no, we can't, because the US supply chain that feeds the Japanese production couldn't get a key component from Boeing, a US supplier.
Mm.
So if you don't establish an alternative supply chain and you're just drawing on the same teat, you'll be subject to the same bottlenecks.
Yes. So if it's simply the assembly of Lego kits where all the components are being imported, it probably doesn't help anybody. So hopefully this NSM enterprise will broaden the supply chain.
Yeah. So it can be an alternative source of production for Australia and our partners and allies.
Well, how about we talk to Kongsberg and we can answer that question in a future podcast.
Yeah.
trust.
Now, another thing where there's been a lot of talk, and last week, this week, I was up at a big conference where this was discussed, the Anduril proposal with Ghost Shark. And apparently Anduril, they had 3 years to produce a prototype of their large uncrewed undersea vessel, otherwise known as an unmanned submarine. They delivered the first prototype in 2 years, 1 year ahead of schedule and on budget, and the government announced they're going to co-fund a factory to do full rate of production for these things. Anduril is presenting about how they've done this, and Defence is celebrating that Anduril is doing this at speed. There's a lot about the Anduril approach that I love. I think the whole business model where they're moving fast to develop things, it's software defined, so it's rapidly changeable. They're designing for manufacture. They're using non-traditional supply chains because they don't want that Japanese Patriot production problem to affect them. They want to get outside the traditional defense industrial base. So they're using suppliers and partners from the medical sector, the resource sector, the retail sector, and they're using a lot of small and medium Australian companies. I think that's terrific. But as far as this being a success about a new way of doing things with the Department of Defense, I think this just shows this is a billionaire who managed to run an insurgency into defense and more or less coerce defense into doing something that many, many other companies have been proposing, but defense has refused to do.
Well, yes, I think it's hard to say that the Anduril process shows that defense's new business model is working, because it certainly circumvented the old business model, and I'm not sure it's complying with the new business model. It is a kind of thing that doesn't follow the defense process at all. So I think defense can't really point to it and say, see, we've fundamentally changed the way we do business.
My point is, this is not defense's business model. Lucky Palmer, one of the founders of Anduril, is a billionaire from his time making Oculus Rift virtual reality headsets and then selling that to Meta. He's a patriot, an American patriot, and he wants to do good things for the US and America, for the US and allies' national security. That's fantastic. But it's this phenomenon of someone cashed up and powerful enough to kick defense's door down. So this is Anduril's business model, inflicted on defense, but being celebrated by defense like it was all their idea.
Well, as you know, Michael, I've done some work with an Australian company, C2 Robotics, that also makes a large UUV. And, you know, I will just point out that we also developed a prototype in under 2 years. And Anduril, congratulations, sent a prototype to the US. Well done. We have also sent a prototype to the US, which the US is very interested in. So Australian companies can do this as well. You don't actually need to have a billionaire backing you. But
well, you may need a billionaire to actually get defence to invest.
Well, we have gotten good support from defence, and that's a very good thing.
Terrific.
But the point I will make is people often ask us, do we see Anduril as a competitor? You're both making large UUVs. And, well, kind of, but the ocean is a big place. And just as we have big aircraft and little aircraft and big vehicles and little vehicles, the ocean is big enough to accommodate a range of UUVs. But we actually like what Anduril is doing because it is bringing disruption.
Yes.
Bringing disruption to this very cozy, monopsony kind of construct we have in the defense space. So I'm sure our listeners are familiar with the idea of monopoly, and defense is essentially a monopoly provider of security
and
goods
and
services.
A monopoly buyer of defense equipment.
Yes, and if you are the sole buyer, that is a monopsony system. And so defense is also the sole consumer of defense goods and services. And so that's created a very cozy kind of system dominated by the primes, which we've spoken about before. And one of the things that Anduril is bringing is disruption, just as Elon Musk and SpaceX has brought disruption
to
the space sector.
Well, I think that's probably the most interesting thing, isn't it? That Anduril and SpaceX, and probably Palantir in the intelligence world before them, they're Silicon Valley tech disruptors coming to the Pentagon and coming to Russell offices here in Australia. And the thing about this new way of doing things is it can eat the traditional incumbent primes lunch. That's exactly what you can see right now with the International Space Station and Boeing's bogged Starliner, with SpaceX having already done about 14 different missions.
Well, see, defense organizations not really unique in what they want, other than having a bunch of high explosive on the front of whatever it is they're using, a missile. Pretty much everybody else wants the same kind of stuff. They want autonomy, for example.
Uber Eats wants delivery services of payloads. Mm. The payloads just happen to be pizzas.
Right. They want to be to deliver massive numbers of payloads very affordably and reliably. And
their competitors aren't using electronic warfare to disrupt their signals and guidance.
Mm-hmm.
Not yet, anyway.
Yeah, so there are some unique requirements in the defence space. But, you know, I was noodling on the back of Beer Coaster the other day, and the market capitalization of the big Silicon Valley firms, whether we're talking Microsoft or NVIDIA. NVIDIA, Ooh. Do you know what it does? It just designs chips and processors. It doesn't make them, does it?
TSMC makes a lot of their stuff.
Its market capitalization is five times the size of all of the five or six biggest defense primes combined.
So Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman.
Yeah. So, yeah, if I was running one of those primes, I'd be looking over my shoulder and saying, wow, these guys are coming after me. Look at SpaceX.
Well,
look at Anduril.
So that's interesting, but I think the disruptive thing is the business model, but the empowering thing is the billionaire. My hope is that the business model is so obviously successful that a whole bunch of Australian companies can then be seen as offering what these disruptors are doing, but doing it with Australian expertise and Australian companies from the start. So I'm hoping Anduril and SpaceX can break down the door, and then the new business model gets embraced by defence, and we use the latent power of the Australian industry.
Sure. Yeah, but the slow bit here is not industry, it's defence. Well, plus, it's also defence, its endless ability to solutionise and to specify the solution. If defence gets out of the way, then industry is responsive enough to meet defence's requirements.
Well, I was at a conference where a whole bunch of defence officials and even a minister were presenting, and there was a big theme out of the officials that, hey, look, after this strategic review and the National Defence Statement and the Service Combatant Review and the GUIO Enterprise Review, the big news for all you companies is schedule is now king. So let me tell you, if you get a contract from us, then delivery and your schedule is king. Nothing can get in the way. We will be demanding schedule is king.
Yes, there is a big if in that, and that is the timeframes in which it takes defence to actually give somebody the contract.
Well, these were the same officials who, when they were talking about procurement reform, and when the new head of the Capability Acquisition and Sustainment Group, CASG, came in, set out his agenda. This is about 2 years ago. He said, procurement reform, that's my number one priority. I'm going to cut the documentation set in half. Well, schedule is king. 2 years on, hasn't happened. Sitting there listening to these defence officials pointing their fingers at companies saying, if you get a contract, schedule is king, and then looking at what they're meant to have done themselves and haven't done over years, I did think there was a lot of barefaced effrontery about the whole thing.
Well, it gets back to that issue of disruption and disruptive innovation. And the lessons are, if you want to do disruptive innovation, you don't start by tweaking your current business as usual business model. And it seems to me that's what defence is trying to do in its procurement reform. You start with this bloated, ineffective system, and you sort of try and trim some of the fat off it, rather than starting from scratch with a completely separate set of principles and drivers.
Well, I bet you that Anduril didn't wend its way through the AsDefCon morass of contract documentation templates and formats to get where they got. That's why I think they're an insurgency. And the right way, as you say, if you want to do procurement reform and you want to produce slim documentation, you don't start with the old-fashioned telephone book A to K and L to Z that is ASDEFCON. You start with a clean sheet of paper.
Yes, the other thing about the schedule of is king messaging we're getting out of defence at the moment is it's a bit like, you know, the reformed alcoholic. Gone from alcoholic who is now a teetotaler and has just got this, I'm going to tell you, you know, how to live your life because I've reformed.
Yeah, if I see someone approaching a can of beer, I'm going to go up and give them a piece of my mind.
You know, and so we seem to have swung from the most ludicrous extreme to another one. So how did we get into our favourite project, the Hunter-class frigate program, where we picked this design and then changed everything? So it's going to be 20 years from the start of that, the future frigate program, to the first Hunter-class frigate providing any real-world capability.
Yes, so
20 years.
So that was probably capability was king. And if time didn't matter, capability was king. But now we've gone the other way. Schedule is king. And the general-purpose frigate seems to me to be a massive overcorrection because there's two previous decisions that the Navy and Defence Department got various ministers to agree. One of them was the combat system on everything but the most capable Navy vessels would be the Saab 9LV combat system. There are hundreds of engineers that have developed this fine product.
Well, even the ships with Aegis also have the Saab 9LV as the interface.
Yep. And the other one was we've got this world-beating phased array radar made by a little Aussie company called CEA. It was such a good company, and the government wanted to control the technology so much.
The government bought it.
They brought it into government ownership. But none of these general-purpose frigates, the German, Spanish, Korean, Japanese.
So we've gone
Korean,
to this other
Japanese,
extreme from change everything because time doesn't matter to
change nothing because schedule is king.
So if we change nothing, we're going to end up with a surface fleet, half of which will have Saab 9LV, CA radars, US missiles, and the other half, which will have whatever combat system, radar, and missiles they come with, whether they're Korean or Japanese or European.
Yeah, so there's two things about the schedule is king thing. One, it doesn't apply to anything that defence does itself. It's unbound by schedule and is incredibly slow, as you can see with procurement reform. And then they've inflicted a perverse own goal by massively overcorrecting, and that could damage the capability that our militaries are going to have, and also undercut two industry successes that, when I look across defence's relationship with Australian industry, are so rare that we should be welcoming them and doubling down on them.
Well, I just find it quite bizarre that if schedule is king and we can actually live with completely off-the-shelf capabilities, what does that say about every defence decision in the last 20 or 30 years?
Well, and it means you shouldn't just be throwing out the massive procurement contracts and templates. That entire, even bigger, slower, forced development set of processes should also be finding its way to the nearest bin fire. We've pretty much covered what we want: missiles, insurgents, and schedule. And I think we're actually on schedule, so this might be the right time.
There's one last little thing I'll throw in there. It's a little pet hobby horse.
I'll consider this a contract change proposal, but go ahead.
Oh, well, then it won't fit into this podcast, Michael, because it'll take a couple of months.
Talk faster, schedule's king.
So F-35B, short takeoff and landing F-35. It's something I think we should be considering. You know, I worked on the 2008 force structure review. It was something we were looking at back then. And there's a lot of arguments against it that people have always wheel out. It's like, oh, well, you know, it doesn't have the same range as the F-35A. Oh, don't even try and think of operating it off an LHD. The list goes on and on. But recently we did see something quite interesting.
You can't operate these things from a small ship. You need a massive ship, bigger than the LHD, surely. What are you going to tell me?
Well, I'm going to tell you that a small Italian aircraft carrier was recently out here to participate in Exercise Pitch Black, our air combat exercises that we perform every year in Northern Australia. And a small Italian carrier came all the way out here carrying some F-35Bs. So it is quite possible to operate meaningful air combat capability off a small carrier using the F-35B. Just saying, Michael.
You're saying the Italians can do it, and you're implying that if the Italians can do it, we can do it too.
Well, you don't even need the ship, is what I'm saying. I mean, there are lots and lots of small runways, unprepared runways throughout our region that would greatly expand where we could operate from. The wisdom out of the US at the moment is dispersal, dispersal, dispersal. F-35B would allow us to disperse. You could operate them off a much larger number of airfields throughout our region. The thing is the advocates of the F-35 are constantly saying, well, it brings so many things to the fight with its integrated sensor suite, its ability to share data. Okay, well, it's the same on an F-35B as on an F-35A.
If our army's got its new littoral mission and it's seized of that.
The word of the day is amphibiosity, Michael.
F-35B, you heard it here first.
Yeah.
All right, thanks very much, Marcus.
Thank you, Michael.